Bonus money death threats in the company mailbag, says AIG CEO Ed Liddy on Capitol Hill.
All the executives and their families should be executed with piano wire around their necks. If the government can't do this properly, we the people will take it in our own hands and see that justice is done. I'm looking for all the CEOs' names, kids, where they live, etc.
There's a man who lives a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. Yet every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow.
Not-so-secret insurance man on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
AIG's Life of Danger continues. Good morning. It's Thursday, March 19th. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea, in for Adora Udoji, who's out with her new baby. Coming up this hour, what $1 trillion and then some can do for you. And we'll hear your take on what the letters AIG should stand for. Lots of clever responses have been coming in. All that and more coming up. But first, we've got your latest headlines.
After all the angst, maybe some legislation. Finally, the House plans a vote on a plan to wipe out the bonus money AIG officials received through taxes, especially special tax. New York Democrat Charles Rangel explains.
Any firm that has given a bonus and received over $5 billion of federal funds, the bonuses that have been received will be taxed at the rate of 90%.
And the other 10%, Congressman Rangel says he's inviting local and state governments to tax that to death. AIG Chief Edward Liddy has another idea. He told Congress he's urging execs to return their bonus money voluntarily. Depending on their rank, Liddy has asked them to give back half or all of the money. He says many have already done so.
And the Fed is pushing some $1.2 trillion into the economy in a bid to help it. It's sending the money out through several channels. Now, it's complicated, but the basic goal is to boost consumer spending through lower borrowing costs. Investors like the surprise move. It set off a market rally that saw the S&P jumping 2% yesterday. We've got more on markets in a bit, and we'll take a fresh look at job numbers in half an hour. We're going to know new jobless claims. Economists think they'll be about the same as last week. We'll bring you a live report once it's out.
Turning the job numbers around is the focus of President Obama's swing through California today. Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger will be on stage with the president at a town hall meeting. Schwarzenegger endorsed John McCain for president, but he supports the Obama stimulus plan. Fans, friends, and family around the world are mourning the late actress Natasha Richardson. Tony Award winner died yesterday following a skiing accident. She leaves behind husband Liam Neeson and two sons. The S&P and the Dow both gained yesterday following the Fed move we've been talking about. The S&P grew more than 2%, finishing at 794, where it begins trading today. AIG anger. Everybody seems to have it. But can you rebrand AIG? What does it stand for?
Good morning. My name is Bruce Cassidy, and I'm calling from down east Maine. AIG, very simple. Always interested in greed.
If you're burned up by AIG, just pick up the phone on your way to work and call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. AIG doesn't stand for American International Group anymore.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. For military families, the big headline yesterday had nothing to do with the economy. It had nothing to do with AIG, and it certainly was relief to thousands, perhaps millions of military families in the United States who've had to deal with something called the Stop Loss Program and are as angry about it as anyone is in the U.S. about AIG. It was the announcement by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates saying that the Stop Loss Program, the controversial indefinite deployment policy of the Pentagon, is now being phased out.
While these changes do carry some risk, I believe it is important that we do everything possible to see that soldiers are not unnecessarily forced to stay in the Army beyond their end of term of service date.
The so-called stop-loss orders allowed the Pentagon to almost indefinitely deploy soldiers, and one of those is Jeremy Wilson. He's a veteran of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, where he served three deployments. He joins us from Section, Alabama. Jeremy Wilson, thanks for being a part of the program.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
From your perspective, and I know it's early in the morning and it probably gives you a headache even to think about, but what is the stop-loss program and how does it sort of indefinitely commit you to military service beyond what you like to think of as a contract with an actual end date?
Well, you get your heart set on, and for lack of a better word, I guess, getting your freedom back. Because some people don't understand that, when you're a soldier, you're a soldier 24/7, and you kind of I equate it sort of to being like in a prison sentence and doing a great job, at your prison, and then your warden pretty much telling you at the end of it, hey, you've done so great, we're going to keep you in an extra, 10 or 11 months.
Yeah, and the other really interesting difference there is that you volunteered to go into this prison. Isn't that right, Jeremy?
Oh, yes, sir, definitely. Yeah.
So in a volunteer army, how can the Pentagon actually enforce this indefinite deployment? What does stop loss actually mean, and how is it not a violation of your agreement?
Well, in your initial phases of entry into any branch of the military, normally you sign a contract for 4 years of active duty and then 4 years of what they call inactive ready reserve, and it's needs of the military. If they need you longer than what you initially sign up for active duty for, then they can keep you up to 8 years.
And this actually happened to you. I mean, in 2006, you were almost done with a four-year contract, and you got a stop-loss order. Where did they send you?
They sent me to Afghanistan, and I was stop-loss for 10 months and a couple of odd days.
What are the stresses on your family and other military families when this sort of thing happens?
Well, you prepare for, I guess, the beginning of the rest of your life, and you have things at home that you've already begun to set up for, and you have things in your own mind that you're already to set up for, and then it just kind of puts everything on hold again,
So the announcement by Secretary Gates yesterday, what's your response to that? I gather relief is one of them.
Well, yes, sir. Technically, I'm still contractually obligated to another year. September 2nd of 2010 is my official end term of service date, and it's a great relief. I've already had one muster order to go back and have a physical and a couple other things just in case I was to be recalled. And I'm excited about it. I think it's a little late, as far as me. But if
well, late, soldiers, late in the sense that you already lost your fiance over this, right?
Well, yes, sir. As you already know from talking earlier, I had a lot of plans to get out September 2nd of 06, and had a fiance, had school lined up, ready to use the GI Bill, start my education, all these things, and probably, I guess, about 4 months into it, I noticed that we were having a little trouble, and 4 months into the deployment, that is, just out of the blue, got a package with an engagement ring back, saying I can't really take this lifestyle anymore. Well, and they own you for a couple more years anyway, so
man,
I'm done.
Well, there's nothing the Pentagon can do about that, but certainly your experience is an indication of how ready families in the military are for this stop-loss policy to be phased out. Jeremy Wilson, have a great day, and good luck to you. Thanks so much for being a part of the program.
Hey, thank you guys for having me. Have a great day. God bless.
It's Jeremy Wilson, veteran of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Because of a stop-loss deployment, he lost his fiance and his plans for school. Hopefully, he'll be able to restart those.
That's a significant story. So many people have had so many things they love and people they love put on the line in ways that we don't even hear much about. I'm very glad to hear that. Want to move on to a national story. Yesterday, company CEO Ed Liddy testified before Congress concerning the retention bonuses being paid out to employees at AIG. Now, AIG has become an acronym for anything. People are making up ones, but this is the insurer that got billions of dollars in federal bailout funds and then executives getting millions in dollars of bonuses, too. Congress members are pointing the fingers about whose fault this is, and fresh from the fray in Washington, D.C., we've got Todd Zwillick of Capital News Connection. Todd, set the scene for us.
I'll tell you, I wish we could cue the Pink Panther music or the Scooby-Doo mystery music right now, because when Liddy was in the subcommittee yesterday, outside the subcommittee was one big case of whodunit. And the whodunit was reporters like myself running all around the Capitol trying to find out who was responsible for taking the language out of the stimulus bill that would have prevented this entire AIG debacle from happening. There was language in there that would have taxed these bonuses and made it very unattractive for them to happen for TARP recipients. At the last second in the conference, which was a very closed affair with Democrats only, by the way, that was taken out. And the trail was leading, and you're running from this senator who's on the banking committee to this senator who's on the finance committee to this person who talked to the Treasury officials. Ron Wyden, who had the original language, whose language it was, said that Summers and Geithner were clear they didn't want it, but they can't take it out. It takes a senator to take it out. Mm-hmm. So it was this case of whodunit, and that's what we were all working on yesterday. And you might know where the trail led to.
Yeah, we have a little bit from Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd, who definitely feels perhaps regret.
The changes at the time did not seem that obnoxious or onerous. None of us had, I didn't certainly have any idea about AIG and these retention bonuses. And so the modifications, the argument was to deal with potential a flood of lawsuits that could have come to the government over the matter. So we agreed to some modification at the time.
So he's the dude? Dodd is the dude?
Dodd is the dude, but in all fairness, Dodd strongly supported the Senate bill, which had the provision in it that would have stopped this. And everyone is clear from Wyden to Dodd on down that it was Treasury that did not want this. Treasury said you have to take it out. And it's not for a nefarious reason. They thought that these bonuses were contractually obligated, and they are, and that they would be sued, and that it might even be unconstitutional to violate the contracts. And that's all very possible, so that's how it happened. So you're talking about Geithner, Summers, and Dodd doing their work for them in the conference.
Well, what about this contractual issue? I mean, is there any move to overhaul tax law concerning bonuses as opposed to dealing with this one specific situation where obviously federal money is involved with their bigger bailout? I mean, have people started to broaden this issue out at all?
Both of those things are going to happen. The bill that's on the House floor this morning taxes 90% for any TARP recipient that got more than for any company that got more than $5 billion in the TARP, and that's for any employee who makes $250,000. Or more after January 1st. That's a lot of numbers. If you make more than 250 and you get a bonus and you're a TARP person, 90%. So that's broadly. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously targeted at AIG. But there are a lot of other TARP companies, trust me, who got more than $5 billion. So any of their bonuses will be affected. The people are working on broader financial reform. The answer is yes. I think there's a broader effort to make sure that companies getting TARP money going forward don't have the opportunity to get Congress and the White House and Treasury into another embarrassing position like this one.
I understand that you have a little to share with us from Nevada Senator John Ensign. I'll let you do that. We're a little short on time.
Yeah. Well, so the House is going to pass this bill today, but listen to Ensign real quick, because what he's giving is sort of a slowdown signal about how a crackdown on AIG's bonuses might fare in the Senate. Listen to this.
We need to find out, first of all, who in the government. In other words, the very people who were responsible for allowing this thing to happen are going to write a law to try to, correct just the. Remember, that's just the small amount. They're talking about doing something for $165 million when $20 billion went out.
So, one word.
The one word is slowly. If Republicans stick together in the Senate, they can slow this down.
All right. Todd Zwillick, Capital News Connection, many thanks, and on to Femi Oke with the headlines.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Do you have good supplemental health insurance? What about estate planning, car insurance? Dents are easy to fix, but liability's the nightmare.
Buddy, we're with AIG.
Oh.
The AIG companies, the strength to be there.
Don't give up. I'll talk myself in.
If AIG is not inspiring your strength and confidence these days and making you a little bit angry, let's channel your anger and let's productively come up with a new slogan for AIG. What does AIG stand for again?
Spencer, calling from Long Island. You're missing AIG easily stands for S's. Including Geithner.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. AIG doesn't stand for American International Group anymore.
Don't worry, he'll tuck himself in. Anyway, the Fed announced its new plan to help stimulate the economy yesterday. The Fed cut interest rates to near zero. They can't go much lower, so they're trying a new strategy called printing money. Roughly $1 trillion will be spent on the mortgage market and treasury securities. The Fed's decision to buy government debt follows months of internal debate. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke had argued against the strategy. To explain where this money is coming from and whether it'll help, we've got Maya McGinnis. She's director of the New America Foundation's Fiscal Policy Program and president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Maya, how are you?
Thank you.
Where is the money coming from?
In some ways, this is kind of a whole process to try to just get money to come out of thin air when you're dealing with the Federal Reserve System, which is pretty much the most opaque of all the financial institutions. There's very little understanding of how this works. So let me try to explain it. The Federal Reserve first had been traditionally doing what it normally does, bringing down interest rates to help make money cheaper in the economy for companies and individuals to borrow and spend. Those rates came down to close to zero, so there's really no more ammunition there. And they've turned to a less traditional technique, which is using money from the Fed balance sheet to purchase assets. And there's been debate about whether this is the right thing to do. We knew they were going to go into the market and buy mortgage-backed securities, some of the debt from Fannie and Freddie. So a lot of things that are being sold in markets that we need to get moving, and they wanted to bump up the demand. But they've also announced they're going to purchase government debt. So on one hand, you're going to be having the government printing treasuries or lending out treasuries in order to get money, and the Federal Reserve is what's going to be giving them money. It's a complicated way to make it avoid looking like printing money, but it's awfully close to printing money.
Well, in fact, it is exactly printing money, because what you're doing is borrowing. You're borrowing from someone, but you're using your own money to pay for. You know, you're borrowing. You're lending to yourself and then buying the asset. So you have to print money to do that, right?
Well, I don't know if you actually I don't know if you have to actually literally print the money, because the Fed can operate without that. I'm not sure if the printing presses are chugging or not, but you're creating more money. That's what you're doing. You're
right.
Putting more money into the economy, which people who are worried about inflation, which is more the minority of people, but they worry. That's how you create massive inflation in the economy. Most people would say that's the least of our problems right now. Getting more money in the economy is what we need to do. It's when things turn around, how do you actually pull it back out of the economy and have kind of an exit strategy from this whole new, riskier than what we've seen before, financial technique?
All right. So on a practical level, does this mean that people will finally be able to qualify for mortgages and get money? There has been a lot of talk about how there needs to be liquidity in the markets. People who have, you know, good credit and who have money sometimes still have a hard time finding lenders. Is this going to ease the banks' unwillingness to lend?
Well, certainly that's the goal of this. And each time the government is doing sort of something I think has to happen, which is coming in, big and strong, and this is certainly a big, strong move, but we've actually had a lot of effort so far to get lending going. We have credit markets and economy that are clogged up, and we've had efforts before that we thought were going to unclog them. They haven't been successful yet. So we're not. Nobody can say with 100% certainty whether this is going to be the one that allows sort of lending to start working again. But certainly we are putting a lot of money in the economy. We are creating a lot more demand for mortgage products through this with the purchases of the mortgage-backed securities. So that means there's a place to put all of these mortgages that could get lent to people who want to buy houses. Like you said, people of good credit in normal times certainly would be able to buy houses. I think it's likely to jumpstart that sector of the economy.
I have to jump in here. What about the Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility, or TALF, which is going to have $200 billion worth of financing for consumer loans and small business loans? What is this? We have so many acronyms already. This one seems to have a $200 billion limit on it, which is a quite generous one. What is this going to do what we were just talking about, or is this set out to do something entirely different?
Well, TALF is going to reach a different market, so it's going to reach small businesses and individuals more directly. So this is actually kind of a direct lending facility. You know, if you can't go to your normal place to get a loan, now you can actually go directly to the federal government, which is what some people have been saying should happen all along. Rather than the federal government propping up financial institutions to do the lending, step in and do some of it on its own. And let me say, sort of following all of the different programs and loan options that are out there is immensely complex. The federal government has gotten into a business it has never been in before. And one of the interesting things to see with this is the rise of the power of the Federal Reserve. The Fed has stepped into parts of the economy that just have not been part of its bailiwick leading up to this at all. Either it will turn out to be successful, and you'll see a very different Fed a few years from now than we've ever seen before.
Right.
It will turn out that it overstepped. We actually have been tracking all of the different roles that the federal government have done to try to take to get the economy going, everything from stimulus to TARP to TALF. All of this is available. We have it on something called Stimulus Watch on usbudgetwatch.org.
TARP to TALF, that was Maya McGinnis, director of the New America Foundation's Fiscal Policy Program and president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And now we go to some responsible news with Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Oh, the pressure. 28 minutes past the hour. Good morning, all. New criminals in New Mexico will be spared death row. The state is the latest to abolish the death penalty. Governor Bill Richardson signed the bill, which starts July the 1st. 14 other states have no death penalty. Defense Secretary Robert Gates recommended Admiral James Stavridis as the next NATO commander yesterday, and if nominated, Stavridis will become the first naval officer to take the post. He's currently head of Southern Command, and he served in the Persian Gulf from 2002 to 2004. In international news, more unrest on French streets today. Hundreds of thousands of people are expected to take part in a national protest over President Nicolas Sarkozy's economic policies. Transportation workers went on strike last night. Airports, schools and post office are also affected. That's a look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. It's possible that this latest crisis for Israel is something of a long-term event, a crisis that's been brewing since 9/11, when the Arab-Israeli conflict, as tense as ever, slipped from the center of the world stage in global affairs, possibly dwarfed by President Bush's war on terror, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, even the conflict between India and Pakistan over all kinds of issues. Or there are short-term consequences to Israel finding itself as isolated in the world as it's ever been as it prepares to inaugurate a new right-wing government. Joining us to talk about the new isolation of Israel is Ethan Bronner, a New York Times writer, Jerusalem-based correspondent, who has a piece on this sense of isolation, which is in some sense not a whole lot new for Israelis, but is manifesting itself in interesting and perhaps frustrating ways. Ethan, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, John. Yes, I mean, the truth is that Israel was, of course, very isolated in the 1970s. 1975, the UN General Assembly declared Zionism to be racism. And then what happened is at the end of the 80s, when Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization began to negotiate and the Oslo process began in the early 90s, there was a flowering of diplomatic activity for Israel. It established relations with India, with a bunch of Arab countries and African countries that had never acknowledged it before. What's happening now is, with the ongoing failure of peace efforts and the fact that Israel has just fought a war in Gaza that many people disapproved of, is that it is feeling a very distinct chill around the world.
And at a time when the diplomatic momentum, either in the peace process or within Israel itself, is at a really low ebb.
At a really low ebb. In fact, assuming the government that looks like it's coming into power comes into power, and we can talk about that in a minute because there is a little blip on that screen, but assuming Benjamin Netanyahu does come in with a narrow right-wing government and has a man named Avigdor Lieberman as his foreign minister, there is every reason in the world to think that that ebb will not go away. That is to say that this is, both of them say that a Palestinian state is not on their immediate agenda.
I wanted to bring up something that is starting to circulate now, which is that there is what's called Durban 2, which is an anti-racism, you know, UN NGO conference. One of them happened right before 9/11 in South Africa, in Durban. And the U.S. and Israel walked out over anti-Zionist, you know, basically Palestinian and other protests. Are you caught up on the state of play with what's being called Durban 2 and whether Israel is still considering going or whether definitely not going?
Israel is absolutely boycotting Durban 2 and has been working for months to get its allies in the United States and in Europe to boycott with it. And the United States has essentially said that it will do so. A number of European countries have as well. What they've all sort of conditioned it on the documents, the preparatory documents of Durban, to unless they're changed, they're not going to come. And that's because of all the conflicts and problems in the world, Israel is singled out in these documents. And therefore, they've all said they're not going to go. Now, if they do not... If they change them, that will be something else. But so far, the change has not been to the satisfaction of Israel or of a bunch of its allies.
Is there a do-or-die date by which changes would need to be made in order to come back and look at the decision?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
The thing is, in a few weeks, so it can't be very far away. My guess is that the boycott will go forward from a bunch of countries, obviously including Israel.
Now, you mentioned before that there's a blip on the formation of the new government under Benjamin Netanyahu. But the face of Avigdor Lieberman as foreign minister is likely to exacerbate just this very Durban issue and other relations, particularly in the Muslim world. How is Lieberman likely to be received in places like Ankara and Turkey?
Well, if Lieberman, in fact, becomes foreign minister, I think it's going to be a very difficult road for him. He's going to be viewed, because of statements he has made about Arabs and about Israeli Arabs and about Egypt and so on, with great hostility. And I think it'll be very hard for him and for Israel to win acceptance. Now, the blip I mentioned is that Benjamin Netanyahu, who is being asked to form this government, is working very hard to persuade parties in the center and left to join him instead of the parties to the right. And there has been some activity on that in the last couple of days. Ehud Barak, the defense minister, seems to want to try to persuade his colleagues in the Labor Party to join the government. The party's been offered a whole bunch of important ministries, and the party seems to be split over it. I don't think we'll know for several days, but that's what's going on.
All right, Ethan Bronner, thanks so much for joining us. Ethan Bronner is the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He spoke with us from Jerusalem about Israel's isolation, an isolation that it's facing in the reception of its sports teams in places like Sweden, Spain, and Turkey. Mauritania has closed Israel's embassy in that country. An isolation for Israel, nothing new, but manifesting itself in a very different way. Ethan Bronner, thank you very much. And now, headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much, John. The time is 22 minutes to the top of the hour. The days of public outrage over AIG bonuses to executives continue. The House is set to vote today on whether to tax those payouts by 90%. Yesterday, AIG boss Edward Liddy testified about the $165 million in bonuses. Politicians and the public alike were angered after learning AIG paid out the bonuses after it received federal bailout money. The bill is seen as largely aimed at AIG, but would also affect employees at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And something for new parents. Crib makers are proposing a ban on drop-side cribs after infant death, injuries and recalls. Members of an industry standards committee says that the plan would end production of the cribs, and that's where one side moves up and down in order to move easily and reach the baby. Now, instead, the proposal would require cribs to have four removable sides, and a consumer group says that at least three
removable
children...
Removable sides?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Four immovable sides, so they shouldn't move at all. Consumer group says that at least three children have died in drop-side cribs over the last 18 months. News from Mexico, where Mexican tariffs on U.S. products take effect today. About 90 products will be affected, ranging from fruit and wine to washing machines. And Mexico slapped the tax on after Congress cancelled a pilot program to allow Mexican truckers to make deliveries in the United States. And the program was started under former President Bush. Mexico says that cancellation of it is a violation of trade agreements. And if you're watching the Tonight Show tonight, you might want to look out for a special guest. It will be President Barack Obama. He will be taping his appearance at about 7 p.m. local time for California. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And to be a middle-aged man these days is to know about the PSA blood test. It's a test for a screening for prostate cancer. But it turns out, according to Gina Collado, who's a reporter with The New York Times, who has a story in today's paper, that that test, the PSA test, may not be as accurate or useful as it's made out to be. Gina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What is the discovery about the PSA test that is so disturbing to men who are relying on it? And then broadly speaking, what does this say for all sorts of cancer tests that attempt to screen for the probability of developing cancer?
Well, what people have always wondered about this test, as they wonder about a lot of cancer screening tests, the problem is the test does exactly what it's supposed to do. It finds a protein that's released into the blood by the prostate and by prostate cancer cells in particular. So if you have higher levels than normal of this protein in your blood, or high levels of this protein in your blood, I should say, then there's a likelihood that maybe you have prostate cancer. You could have other things. You could have an infection, for example. So doctors do a biopsy. They take some cancer cells. They take some cells out of your prostate, and if they find cancer, then you have to make a decision. Should you have treatment or not? And almost everybody, knowing that they have cancer in their prostate, is going to say, yes, please, treat me. And the treatments often have some pretty serious side effects. They can involve impotence, incontinence, or if you have radiation, you can end up with chronic diarrhea. These are not easy treatments. They're difficult treatments. But here's the issue. So suppose the cancer you found is growing so slowly that you would never have known it was there if you had not had that screening test.
Right.
I mean, then you're being treated for something that's not going to help you. Or suppose it's already spread. Even though it looks really tiny, it's already spread. So removing your prostate doesn't make any difference if you've got that cancer, and treatment isn't going to cure you. Well, that was always been a question. The screening, if you find it early, are you helping people, or are you subjecting a lot of people to unnecessary treatment, either because their cancer is growing too slowly or because it's growing too fast?
Gina, is there essentially, and we don't have a lot of time, but in the sense, is this about the disconnect between what goes on in individual cells or on the sort of protein level versus what actually happens in the body when cancer really manifests itself? And that disconnect means tests are a problem.
This is a question of benefits and risks of being screened for prostate cancer and, in general, other cancers, although many of the screening tests have not been studied as well. And the only way to know these questions is to do screening tests on large numbers of men and ask others to forego the test, follow them for years, decades even, or maybe a decade or more, and ask, are there more deaths in the group that was screened from prostate cancer than in the group that wasn't? Because the whole point of this is to try to reduce prostate cancer deaths.
Are those tests likely to be done, those studies likely to be initiated at this point?
That's what was just done. Those were the studies.
Those
are the studies that we're talking about today.
So then should men get these PSA tests, or should they just...
What the recommendations of the experts are that I spoke to is that men should understand very clearly what the risks are and what the possible benefit is. One study found no benefit, no reduction in deaths from prostate cancer.
So
the other found a very small reduction after 10 years.
So a puzzle for middle-aged men considering the PSA blood test for prostate cancer. Gina Collado is a reporter for our partners, The New York Times.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Emergency, this is no drill. At least it's not for author Neil Strauss, who we're going to talk to in a moment, right after headlines from Femi. Okay?
Thank you very much, John. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. We have new figures out this hour from the Labour Department. The number of people filing new claims for jobless benefits fell to 646,000 last week. Wall Street has been anticipating those numbers. It's headed for a mixed open. And that's after a late-day rally yesterday following the Fed announcing it would buy up $1 trillion in government bonds and mortgage debt. The Dow closed up more than 1%. Big muscles and bipartisanship are in store for California today. President Obama holds a town hall meeting in Los Angeles with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. The Republican campaign for John McCain in the election, and some GOP governors have rejected money from the Obama stimulus plan. But Schwarzenegger backs the stimulus, putting him in his party's minority. A massive wave of worker strikes is slowing France down today. Union members are protesting the French president's economic policy. They say he hasn't done enough to fight the recession and protect jobs, and all kinds of people are striking, from teachers to mail carriers to transit workers.
I love the French. We'll show you in this recession. We'll stop working completely. That will show you. It's insane. It's ridiculous. You can't stop a recession by having a strike.
You can't?
No. French people are going to come over here.
Strike for other reasons, but not that reason.
They're going to come over here. You know that Nolita is not far from here,
right,
where
they'll
the French folks live. They're going to come and get you. Anyway.
Femi, one more story. One more story, Femi.
Okay. I'm going to change the tone slightly, unfortunately. We're getting a lot of tributes in. Loved ones and fans are mourning the late actress Natasha Richardson. The Tony Award winner died yesterday at a New York hospital following a skiing accident on Monday.
And I wanted to get that in. It happened late, and a lot of people might not know that. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
And now
it's time for AIG. The big wigs are justifying their big bucks bonuses, but does getting mad help you get even? Use your anger productively. Rebrand AIG.
Hi, my name is Jason Maluski. I'm from Detroit, Michigan. I got a thing for what AIG stands for, especially for the execs that screwed the whole company. I think that for them, AIG stands for Ain't It Grand.
Probably does. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. You know, whatever is going on with us here in the studio, our listeners bail us out.
They do.
They absolutely do.
I love it.
But now it's an emergency, folks. Whether we're talking about the economic crisis or the aftermath of 9/11, Americans are predisposed to think actually pretty negatively about the future these days. Joining us now is Neil Strauss, former New York Times rock critic. He lives in Los Angeles and has penned the book Emergency, This Book Will Save Your Life, which is a narrative of how Neil Strauss, as a matter of exploring American culture, delved into all of the impulses to respond to emergency that Americans have, from putting their money offshore to buying guns to learning how to drive a survivalist motorcycle. Neil Strauss, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back on.
And we had a little problem with the electronic connections a few hours ago, but we've...
Yeah, it's funny, too, because one of the things I learned while I was doing this is the government has an amazing program because, of course, it takes care of its own, called the Wireless Priority Service. I don't think most about this, but I actually became a government worker. It's one of the things I did to protect myself. And you can actually get precedence over all other outgoing calls on your cell phone by hitting a certain code that the kind of government has.
That's
pretty
interesting.
Cool to know that stuff.
So what did you discover about America turning your entire life into a emergency response impulse?
I mean, I discovered a number of things, but one thing I really discovered is when one becomes, let's say, it's not really about being any safer, because really, if it's happening to you, it's going to happen a lot of times. It's really about peace of mind. We fear the unknown. We fear the things we can't control. And right now, we just feel like a victim of the economy, you know, a victim of the threat of terrorism, a victim of maybe decisions that political leadership made in the past that we didn't approve of. And I think one can, by becoming self-sufficient, by becoming independent of these things we can't control, and also by making them known to us, you know, we feel like we have a little bit more control over our lives and peace of mind.
Now, that, of course, is the myth that Americans try to embrace when they, you know, adopt these control mechanisms. But I'm surprised how many business people who would seem to have all they would ever need squirreled away in the bank are some of the most nervous folks.
It's how they define them. I mean, who's not scared? The homeless people aren't scared because they're already survivalists. They're already getting by with nothing. You know, it's just true. The more you have to lose, you know, the more you fear losing it.
So how hard is it to take your money and put it offshore or to get another passport? You tried to become a citizen of St. Kitts in this book.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I think it's really hard to get your money offshore because if you put your money offshore, the government assumes that you're trying to evade taxes. So they have deals with all the banks. And, you know, I always heard of the myth of a Swiss bank account, and I went to try to get one, and no bank would take – there are only two banks, actually, that would take an American citizen, but only for deposits that were in the millions and millions of dollars. So it's actually incredibly difficult because the government kind of has its fingers anywhere. In fact, here's something interesting. If you want to say you are sick of paying taxes, you decide to renounce your American citizenship so you don't have to pay taxes, you still owe the government taxes for 10 more years, even if you're not a citizen anymore.
Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No,
you know, I take these projects because you don't find out what happens until you actually try to do it. Go ahead, Farai. Sorry.
No. I'm just curious. Your book is Emergency.
Right.
And then there years ago was a runaway hit, a good book that became a terrible TV series called The Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbook.
Right.
What are the tonal and structural differences between those two books?
Oh, yeah. You know, they're completely different because it's like here's everything that can happen and here's what you do. This was more kind of my personal story of, oh, my God, all these horrible things are happening in the world. I had a mini, you know, generational panic attack because we haven't experienced a lot of these things before in America, and they're pretty dire, especially if you read, you know, books about the fall of great empires. And it was just my steps that I was taking to just protect myself, and it came from my own sort of need to do this. And interestingly enough, the turn it kind of takes at the end of what I do now is once I learned all these safety tips, my plan wasn't to write a book out of it. I actually joined a search and rescue team. I became EMT. And now if there's a disaster, instead of running to the Caribbean island, I'm actually there in the trenches working with people, on the Metrolink.
No, that's okay. But as you develop these skills, and congratulations for becoming an EMT, how did the people around you react to you buying guns and learning how to use a big hunting knife and, driving a motorcycle?
It's so funny. And by the way, it goes back to your earlier point, which is the things we do to make us safe, and that these billionaires and these other people are doing to make them safe, such as flying planes and guns and motorcycles, are actually the most dangerous things we've done in our lives. You're really increasing your odds of death. But more to the point, when I originally did it, they really thought I was crazy. My friends wanted to talk about whether Rock Band was better than Guitar Hero. That was more interesting of a subject to them. Now, though, even my parents, who were really down on it, asked me about getting a second citizenship. Now my friends, I have chickens and goats at home, so I can kind of prepare and make my own food, want to get these things. So now that people are feeling the pinch in their own pockets, now they're losing their jobs and seeing friends losing their jobs and seeing banks collapse, it's a whole new story.
So does having chickens and goats and handguns make you feel better?
You know what? The truth is this. Having chickens is awesome, and having goats is great, because the truth is, you only live once. This is what people did for most of their lives. And, a chick costs $3. And you can buy the whole factory for a carton of eggs. And it's fun. So even if nothing happens, the fact that I can, make bread, that I can grind grain, that I can do things that, I never thought I'd do and understand how things work rather than being dependent on, the grocery stores and the internet to get me by.
And if anybody comes after your eggs, you just blow them away, right?
Well, if a coyote comes after my coyote, exactly.
Inappropriate laughter over here.
If a coyote comes after my goats, maybe.
Well, Neil Strauss, it hasn't made you antisocial, that's for sure. Neil Strauss,
An armed society is a polite society.
There we go. it's certainly my response to an emergency. Emergency, this book will save your life, by Neil Strauss, New York Times best-selling author and former New York Times rock critic. He lives in Los Angeles and joined us by phone from Chicago. Thanks, Neil.
All right, thanks for having me on. Bye, John.
And I just want to make clear that those were phrases. Those were not my personal beliefs. As a journalist, I have none. How about you?
Yeah, well, you have personal beliefs and chickens and goats, right? You carry them with you on
really.
The plane? That's right. So AIG may make you mad, but let's use that anger productively, okay? What does AIG stand for?
Patrick Tracy from Dayton, Massachusetts. And my AIG acronym is AND IT'S GONE.
Not completely. They're trying to get it back on Capitol Hill. Tell us your new AIG brand at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Got a takeaway for you.
When you're a soldier 24/7. I equate it sort of to being like in a prison sentence and doing a great job, at your prison, and then your warden pretty much telling you at the end of it, hey, you've done so great, we're going to keep you in an extra 10 or 11 months.
That's Jeremy Wilson, a veteran of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, talking about the voluntary prison called being in the Army. He's talking about stop loss. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said he's planning to phase it out. Anything on our show is also on our podcast at our website.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Check it out. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Way back in the 1990s, it was Sweden that faced the worst banking crisis in history. Can they help us?
I can't remember what I did. I was just a little kid.
Oh, no. You must remember. The home of pop tunes like this, ABBA and IKEA, has financial advice for America in its moment of crisis. Swedish meatballs on Capitol Hill. I'm serious. Lessons for lunch on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. No lie, Sweden is going to be advising the U.S. today on Capitol Hill. We'll have more in a moment. It's Thursday, March 19th. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea, in for Adora Udoji, who's off spending time with her new child. Coming up this hour, 407 pages of the stimulus bill. Not exactly a beach read, but you'll meet someone who's going to read cover to cover.
He's my hero.
Yeah, you'll get a chance to also remake the three most hated letters in the country right now, A-I-G. All this and more coming up, but first, your top headlines.
Fresh numbers on new unemployment are out. Something of a mixed bag. New claims fell more than expected, but the number of people continuing to file for unemployment insurance hit a record high. The figure is worse than economists predicted. Sometimes mere hundreds of billions won't do. That's why the Federal Reserve is stepping up with a surprise move to shovel some $1.2 trillion into the economy. It's complicated, or simple, depending on how you view it. It's basically printing money. The idea is to boost consumer spending by pushing down borrowing costs. Investors like the move, though. It set off a market rally that saw the S&P close a bit more than 2%.
And by hook or by crook, we will get that bonus money back. That's the message from Congress to AIG staffers. Today, the House votes on a bill to wipe them out using that blunt instrument called taxes. The proposal will slap a 90% tax on the bonuses. AIG boss Edward Liddy testified to lawmakers that he's telling people in his company that he wants them to do a refund.
I've asked the folks at AIG FP to, in fact, return that money, give it back. At least 50% of it, and for the leadership group, 100% of it.
And he says several executives already returned their bonuses.
Bipartisanship and biceps in California today. President Obama will share a town hall stage with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. The president will plug his economic policy. Farai, you have a sad story.
Yeah, very sad story we've been tracking. Natasha Richardson, one of the greatest, actors in the full fledge of her career, died yesterday following a skiing accident, and she leaves behind her husband. Liam Neeson, also a wonderful actor, two sons.
The S&P and the Dow gained yesterday, as we mentioned. The S&P begins trading at 794. Oil is also popping up. It topped $51 a barrel this morning. AIG, what's it stand for? Not American International Group.
Hi, I'm just going to give you my take on what I believe the acronym for AIG stands for, and that is Avarice is Great.
We've hit a chord at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Channel your anger over AIG productively. Come up with the new thing that it stands for, not American International Group. Avarice is Great, the latest candidate. What's yours?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I'm Farai Chidea. And for Adora, later on the show, we're going to be talking about microloans. You've probably heard about microlending overseas, sometimes as much as a couple dozen dollars, sometimes a few hundred. Not a lot of money, but what if you were asked to invest right here in the U.S.? An online microlender, Kiva, is launching a program in the U.S. later this year. Would you be willing to make a loan to someone in your community, particularly a community that's undergoing a financial crisis? What would you be worried about? What would be the benefits? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. John?
Part of our look at the sort of shadow economy. Shadow, not in a negative sense. Mm-hmm. 28 million Americans don't even use banks, and we're looking at places where financing and credit and capitalism can work outside of the high-profile financial sector that's getting so much attention, like AIG. And the CEO of AIG, Ed Liddy, yesterday on Capitol Hill, was sort of juggling grenades from members members of Congress. Well, he's not likely to be raked over the coals when he goes up to Capitol Hill today. Bo Lundgren is the director of the Swedish National Debt Office. And at the top of the hour, we talked about how Sweden had a debt crisis and a financial crisis back in the 1990s. And Mr. Lundgren is set to testify in front of the Congressional Oversight Committee to help us understand what the strategy was in Sweden that successfully solved that crisis in the early 90s. Bo Lundgren, thanks so much for joining us from Washington.
Thank you. Very nice to talk to you.
First of all, you know, Sweden is a very different country from the United States in the sense of size and diversity of population, climate. How is the Swedish example translatable and scalable to this much bigger crisis that the U.S. finds itself in?
You're right. We're a much smaller country, and of course, things are more complex now. What we had was a regional problem, a regional crisis. Now you have a global crisis, which affects also Sweden and other countries all around the world. So of course, there are differences. On the other hand, when you have a banking crisis, there are things that you have to do, if it's a big economy or if it's a small economy. You have to maintain liquidity in the financial system, which the Fed is doing here now. And you have to, as a government, also help out and see to it that you'll have confidence restored in the system. And you have to do it in one way or another. We did a blanket guarantee. And then you have, of course, to do the capital injections needed to get the capital base for lending back to normal again. And if the private sector doesn't do it, you have to do it as a government. So these were the guidelines we followed.
Mr. Lundgren, what does a blanket guarantee mean, and who and what were you guaranteeing?
We were guaranteeing when we came into this systemic crisis, a complete collapse in the financial sector, we guaranteed that no creditors or depositors would lose anything. Of course, the shareholders had to pay first. We didn't want to bail out the shareholders, so we were very tough on the owners and management in banks, which meant that we didn't nationalize, which is the picture here, so many banks. Some of them managed on their own due to the hard conditions we had to do capital injections.
Now, who extended credit to Sweden to allow you to make good on that guarantee and to retire the assets that were troublesome in the Swedish economy? And I gather the U.S. doesn't necessarily have the same options for financing that Sweden did.
Well, the main financing you have to do through the central bank, or at that time I wasn't director of the debt office since I was a minister, but the debt office also borrowed a lot of money, which was used both to handle our recession in the economy, the deficit in the budget, but also to be able to lend to the banks that were in need of funding. So like the Fed today borrows a lot more than they normally should have done. It's a possibility for all countries to finance them as long as there are investors out there who want to do it.
I wanted to ask about the politics of this. I understand that the plan that you ultimately were able to pull together required the participation of opposition parties. Is that correct?
Yes, we were a four-party minority government and had a populist party, so it was a rather difficult political situation. And that is one of the advantages, perhaps, of being a small country, that if you have a crisis, it's easier to get political consensus. But one thing that helped us very much was that when I took office in October 91, it was just after an election we had the crisis. I wouldn't have, if I can choose, a banking crisis just before an election like you had last autumn. It's more difficult to have the political consensus even within parties.
So, Mr. Lundgren, I wonder if I might sort of lead you in a slightly different direction.
Sure.
Will you listen to this? I mean, the idea that the Swedes are going to be an example for the U.S. economy has made some in America who, you know, maybe are a little bit xenophobic, maybe who like to poke fun, has given them a bit of a field day. And I wonder if you could comment on this for a moment. Here's Stephen Colbert, a noted American commentator.
The Swedish model. And not the good kind that marries Tiger Woods. No. They're talking about Swedish economic policy. You see, in the early 1990s, Sweden's economy collapsed. So, what did they do? They nationalized their banks, returned stability to the assets, and then sold off the restructured companies back to the private sector. But I say, just because that worked doesn't mean I have to become Swedish.
So, Bo Lundgren, here you've got people making sport of the fact that Sweden is going to help us out here. I mean, poor superpower America can't take a little advice from Sweden. What do you make of that?
I mean, obviously, as I said, Sweden is a small country, already in the mid-90s, for instance, Alan Greenspan referred to the Swedish crisis. I mean, we were lucky to some extent, and we tried to learn from others as well. I mean, the way we categorized the banks that have problem was borrowed from the 1933 handling of the crisis in the U.S., for instance. We learned from some of the mistakes that were made during the savings and loans crisis and didn't want to repeat that as well. Of course, as I said, there are many differences, but there are also a lot of misunderstandings. Sweden isn't a socialist country. We didn't socialize or nationalize more than two banks, and one was already partly government-owned. The others managed on their own due to the way we handle the situation. Of course, you shouldn't go and do it the Swedish way. But as we look to the U.S. and to other countries for experiences, I think that it's always good to look at others to find if there is something you could use out of that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this nationalization issue. Americans are very sensitive about it, and it sounds as though it was a controversial issue to some extent in Sweden when you were dealing with it in the early 90s. Are you confident that the way Americans are dealing with this nationalization question, maybe tiptoeing to the edge without actually jumping over, is going to be effective here? Or should the Treasury come clean and basically call a spade, if I might use an overused phrase here?
Well, first of all, I'm a market liberal myself. We were a center-right government. Of course, we didn't want to nationalize anything, and the Swedish business sector isn't much nationalized. France's business sector is more nationalized than Swedish. But what you have to understand is that if a bank has a problem and you have to do capital injection into that bank, you shouldn't bail out shareholders. I mean, it's market economy. If you have to take a large share of the capital in the bank, then of course you should have the same both voting power and rights and responsibilities that come with that. That is market economy. To be honest, I cannot really understand why shareholders should be bailed out by capital injections that carry no voting rights. Of course, I don't want to nationalize, but if you have to do it, it's crisis management.
So it's interesting because the Citibank, they're very worried about the shareholders as the stock goes to zero, right?
Yeah, but if the people are saying that governments are not good owners. That's right. I mean, governments shouldn't run businesses, shouldn't run banks. But obviously, those people that ran the banks now here haven't done a very good job, to put it mildly. So why should the shareholders that have left Citigroup or other banks in this state, why should they be bailed out?
Good point.
You know, what do you think, ultimately, your country would be like if you hadn't done this massive intervention?
We would, of course, have the same situation like Japan. In Japan, they didn't act resolutely as we tried to do anyway. I mean, we did, of course, mistakes ourselves. But they had a prolonged crisis that lasted almost 15 years with slow growth and problems in the economy, and they still have some effects of that.
Some say it's still going on. So, Bo Lundgren, you're headed up to Capitol Hill. Any sense that the Swedish example for dealing with the financial problem is likely to be in the United States as popular as, say, Swedish pop music or IKEA when we look back on this?
Well, I don't think, as I said, I don't think that you can take what we did and transform that to the American way of handling the crisis. But I think that you could, for instance, not be afraid to nationalize a bank if that's what you need to do in order to take your role as a responsible owner of the bank, for instance.
Well, Bo Lundgren, director of the Swedish National Debt Office that was responsible for getting Sweden out of the financial crisis in the early 1990s. Good luck on Capitol Hill, sir.
Thank you very much.
And AIG's bigwigs are justifying big bonuses. But what about you? Feeling angry? You know, tell us your new AIG brand, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So the sign on the skyscraper in Lower Manhattan says American International Group, but you know what AIG stands for, right?
Hi, it's Paul Kleiser from Atlantic Highlands. I'd call them the Anti-Integrity Goon Squad.
What does AIG stand for? Productively channel your anger over the bonuses that are creating sparks on Capitol Hill at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Possibly killing careers, but creating a time of exploration, especially for one man named Steve Call. He is going where no stimulus has gone before. Those words come from his blog on the entire 470 pages of the stimulus. Previously, he reported on the secret history of the CIA and the legacy of the bin Ladens. But this time, regarding the stimulus, he's been blogging as he goes in what reads like a combination of explanatory journalism and travelogue. Steve Call is the president of the New America Foundation and staff writer for The New Yorker. He came up for air this morning to give us the lowdown on his journey through the colossal document. So, Steve, 5-year mission, 10-year mission, will America be on its feet by the time you finish?
I'm afraid that it might be well recovered. I did this sort of spontaneously, looking at the bill, thinking that it was 407 pages. How long could it take to really read and digest it and write something useful about it? And it's quite dense, page to page. There's a lot of information and mystery on each page, so I found that the going so far has been slow. I'm hoping to hit large patches of legalese that'll speed me along, and occasionally I do.
You have had little helper elves who write you, whether it's people who write and respond to your blog or people. Didn't someone turn you on to one of the conference documents that gave you a decoder ring to the budget?
Yeah, I was sort of early on trying to figure out how much outside help to solicit, but I put my email address in there and asked for qualified inside advice, and I have gotten helpful advice of that kind, some of it sort of offline and quiet tipping and some more public commentary. But one of the early writers explained that I could solve some of the mysteries that were befuddling me by turning to the document that the negotiators produced from the reconciliation conference between the House and the Senate. They basically write cheat sheet notes, crib notes on the side of the bill that are intended to give guidance to the bureaucracy and to courts if the bill is challenged. So I've been making use of that, and I get other tips of a similar quality from time to time.
All right. I want to go into a specific now. The reality is that there's so many different things here, but one that I was intrigued by that you've blogged about is the census. Are politics really going to take the center in the fight over this billion-dollar plan to add new census takers?
Well, it's a great subject, and because what it shows you is that if you basically take the government as it is and you inject a lot of new money into a particular area, you can create the perception that you're doing this to make a better government, or you can create the perception that you have a political agenda. And that's what happened with the census, which, of course, is coming up in 2010. And one of the big issues that is not necessarily political, you could say it's scientific, that's been surrounding the census the last time, two or three times through, is that under our Constitution, census takers, in order to count the people properly, in order to allocate power in our political system, they have to physically count people. They can't just estimate how many people there might be. And it turns out that poor people and minorities generally are harder to count because they are sort of off the grid. They may not have fixed addresses. They may not be responsive to people with clipboards. They may be suspicious of the system. So there's been a lot of effort to figure out how to properly count them so that they are enfranchised as they should be. And the Democratic-controlled Congress sees pumping a lot of money into the census as a way to do the right thing almost scientifically, whereas the Republican Party sees it as a political project to effectively overcount Democratic-leaning votes.
You know, you've spent a lot of time looking into the inner workings of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Steve. I'm wondering, as you look at this bill here and this stimulus package and all of the arms of government that are going to be spending this money on every level, is it a visionary document that takes us in a new direction, or does it basically give money for a lot of stuff that reinforces the status quo?
That does both things. And it would be very interesting. I'm hoping maybe by the time I get to the end to try to do some math and at least approximate for my own sort of analysis how much is transformational and how much is same old on steroids, which itself is stimulative in a technical economic sense, but maybe not your, you know, sort of the ideal way to spend the money. The transformational investments include some big investments in a new energy grid that will promote renewables, include what the president has called down payments on the new technology that's required to fix our healthcare system, increase access and reduce costs, and in the education sector as well. But there's quite a lot of, you know, sort of existing programs that are just given a very large additional dollop of money without any particular idea that this is going to change the kind of country we live in after the stimulus is gone.
Well, we're all looking ahead to see what kind of country we end up in, but a few of us have the stick-to-itiveness that you have about blogging the entire plan. That's Steve Call, president of the New America Foundation and staff writer for The New Yorker. Thank you so much, and we are about to get another helping of the news of the day with Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much, Fry. The time just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. The death penalty is no more in New Mexico. Governor Bill Richardson has signed a bill to abolish capital punishment in the state, making it the 15th state to do so. The new law replaces lethal injection with a sentence of life without parole, and the repeal takes effect from July the 1st, applying to crimes committed after that date. Now, we have been asking you for your alternative acronyms for the insurance giant AIG. Democratic Congressman Gary Ackerman didn't rebrand AIG, but he has come up with a snappy new slogan for one of their business practices.
And they're calling it credit default swaps, because if they called it, I can't believe it's not insurance, maybe nobody would buy it. This is exactly, I mean, it's a funny joke I made up, but this is exactly what's happening. And it's not funny because all of us who are laughing are crying.
That's Congressman Ackerman. He was talking to the House Finance Services Committee. New jobless claims fell more than expected last week, but continuing claims set a new record. That number has been rising for 8 straight weeks. And this comes from a new report that came out just last hour. In international news, jobs are also on the minds of the French. Mass worker protests are happening right across the country and expected to swell to hundreds of thousands. Protesters want to turn up the pressure on President Nicolas Sarkozy to do more. And reports say that North Korea has detained 2 American journalists near its border with China. The 2 reporters work for California-based multimedia outlet Current TV, and the pair apparently ignored warnings to stop taping. And that's a look at stories making headlines this morning for I.
Thanks so much, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. If you're angry about AIG, find a way to creatively and productively channel your anger and energy, perhaps coming up with a new slogan for AIG. I mean, what does AIG stand for? Not American International Group.
Hi, this is Nancy from New Jersey. AIG, apparently I'm greedy.
Hello, this is Sue of Everett, Washington. I think AIG should be absolutely incredible greediness.
8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. You know, many more calls. All of you are winners on the Takeaway.
Lights, camera, action!
time for what we call an outtake, a perspective you're probably not going to hear anywhere else. Even though the financial meltdown has caused people to think very, very differently about policy and government and maybe combining notions of policy in ways that we haven't thought of before. Joining us now is Richard Lefrak, chairman and CEO of the Lefrak Organization, a real estate builder and developer here in New York and around the United States. We're spending $275 billion on a federal housing market bailout plan, but will it work? Will it actually keep people in their homes? And more importantly, will it encourage people to buy homes that are already sitting vacant, either because of foreclosure or because they haven't sold? Richard Lefrak, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning.
What's your suggestion to actually very, very differently approach this housing crisis as a way of incentivizing people to get into homes that are either abandoned or not selling?
Well, it's based on the premise that house prices are set at the margin. And right now we're in a non-virtuous cycle of falling house prices. House prices are going down. People's home equities are going down. People are feeling bad about not only their investment in their house, but the economy in general. And in order to fix that problem, house prices have to be stabilized. In order to stabilize prices, there are several ways to deal with it, and some of the suggestions made by the new bill that the administration has put out are costly and will be an assistance, but overall do not deal with the biggest underlying cause of falling house prices. That cause is the fact that we just built too many damn houses in this country, and we have a big oversupply of inventory that's unsold. And empty homes are the mortal enemy of house prices.
So what's your suggestion for creating a radically new incentive for getting people in those houses?
Well, our incentive is that the internal demand to absorb these empty houses will take at least 2 to 2.5 years to absorb the oversupply. And so what we're suggesting is that we have to look for some exogenous demand, outside demand, and that demand could come from immigrants who would come to the United States and be given access to this country. And I use the word access, deliberately, in exchange for buying a house.
Visas for houses.
Visas for houses.
So your family, your organization, Lefrak Organization, built Lefrak City, which is, if you live in New York, you know that there's these developments that are just enormous. You have Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper Village, and then Lefrak City is its own city and yet part of New York, also in Queens. I mean, are you seeing that a city like New York needs the immigrant solution? New York always has immigrants, or are you really talking about other parts of the country?
Well, New York has the immigrant solution because we're a gateway city for immigration, and anybody who visits New York, Queens in particular, knows that it's like the United Nations. But I'm suggesting that the inventory that's most prevalent is in Florida, Arizona, Nevada, and Southern California. And those markets are particularly desirable right now for, let's say, potential buyers from either Europe or from Asia. And we could attract buyers from those places to come buy up those houses, stabilize the housing prices, if we gave them some sort of access visa to get in, to have residence in this country as part of their house price purchase. Of course, they have to be vetted for their citizenship qualities, meaning we want good neighbors here. But I'm saying that that's a very easy and no-cost solution for us to stabilize housing prices, which will eventually rebuild the bank's balance sheets, put capital in the banks, lift all home prices for everybody, and also get people who are on the margin of deciding whether to buy or not to make a decision now, because house prices are very affordable now. And interest rates are very low.
Yeah, I just have to ask this question. I mean, couldn't there be a huge anti-immigrant backlash if you introduce people who come in, seem to have some money, which they would have to buy a house, but then there's a 10%+ unemployment rate by the time they get here?
Well, first of all, I'm not necessarily advocating that they come here to work.
But they'd have to do something.
Well, they can live, they can go to school. They have a lot of other things that they could do here, okay? These are not necessarily people that are going to come here and be fighting at the lowest level for jobs on automobile assembly lines or, you know, in construction. They're people who are going to come here that already have capital, that can start businesses, that have entrepreneurship, or have such a high level of skills that they would qualify for these visas that are related to people with extraordinary skills. I think they're called H-1B visas, which we give out regularly anyway to people with advanced degrees in computer science, engineering, and other disciplines.
Very quickly, this worked as a stimulus in Vancouver when it was tried at a very high level of the income bracket. Could it really work here?
Well, if you think about the fact that I believe our country is still the most desirable place for many people to come and live, and probably if you ask people around the world what's their second choice to have a home, meaning in their own country, where else would they like to have access? I think the United States would be high on many people's lists.
Visas for houses as a way of stimulating the real estate part of the economy that's so much a part of this economic downturn. Richard Lefrak, thanks for that outtake. He's chairman and CEO of the Lefrak Organization. And now Femi Oke has some headlines.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, the U.S. dollar has slipped in value a little bit. This follows the Federal Reserve's announcement that it's putting some $1.2 trillion into the U.S. economy. Oil prices shot up over $50 a barrel today, and the increase comes after rallies in global stock markets. In international news, Israel has detained 10 senior Hamas leaders from the West Bank. The arrests come just after talks over a prisoner exchange broke down. An Austrian man has just been convicted, and he's been accused of imprisoning and sexually assaulting his daughter for decades. Jurors didn't immediately sentence him, but he faces life in prison. Mexican tariffs on dozens of U.S. goods kick in today. Mexico made the move after Congress ended a pilot program that allowed Mexican trucks to work in the U.S. The tariffs affect more than $2 billion in annual trade, and products include everything from food to appliances. That's a look at news making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry with Farai Chidea. And an update now on a story we've been following all morning. Communist authorities in North Korea apparently have detained two American journalists working near the border of China. The Associated Press is reporting that those American journalists are Laura Ling and Yuna Lee, and reporters for the California-based media outlet Current TV. We caught up with BBC correspondent John Sudworth earlier this morning. He's in Seoul, South Korea. And when we spoke, I asked John, what were the circumstances particularly of this detention?
The reports of their arrest first appeared in South Korean news publications, reporting that the two journalists had been picked up close to the North Korean-Chinese border. The reports here were all sourcing South Korean government officials, and the suggestion is that the two journalists concerned were working on some kind of a news report to do with North Korean refugees who cross that border with China all the time in search of a better life. It's not unusual for journalists to go to that part of the world to cover exactly that kind of story. We have had a comment from the State Department saying that they're aware of the reports. They're asking the Chinese government to help ascertain the whereabouts and welfare of the Americans in question. And they've also been in touch with North Korean officials to express their concern.
Let's talk a little bit about the North Korean precedent in these kinds of detentions. Now, assuming that these journalists did violate some sort of territorial integrity and that there would have been administrative reason for their detention, subsequently, these people have a tendency to become a bit of a bargaining chip in a broader North Korean face-off over nuclear issues and other kinds of things. What is the chance that these people might be held for a considerable length of time based on what's happened in the past?
Well, I think you're right. I think there will be concern that the release may be a long and protracted issue to negotiate. There is some past precedent. Back in 1996, a young American man crossed the border and was detained by North Korean officials after swimming across the Yalu River. It was described at the time as an incident of, if you like, high spirits by the young man in question. It certainly got him into a lot of trouble. His release took 3 months to secure. A few years prior to that, there was an American businesswoman who was detained by North Korea on unspecified charges for a month or so. And again, her release took direct country-to-country negotiations to sort out. I think the thing people will be concerned about at this time is, of course, these reported arrests come at a time of mounting tension here in Korea. North Korea says it's preparing to put a satellite into orbit early next month. Washington has been insisting that they stop those preparations because it believes that, in fact, the goal of the rocket launch is the development of long-range missile technology, which Washington believes will be in breach of UN resolutions. So this is a time of heightened tensions, and I think there will be a concern that those considerations may eventually end up weighing into the process of trying to secure their release.
Two people detained. That was BBC correspondent John Sudworth earlier this morning reporting on the American journalists who have been detained by North Korean authorities. John spoke to us from Seoul, South Korea, in an interview we did as we were following the details of that story. So AIG, what does it stand for, huh?
Hi, this is Chris Van Dyke calling from Washington Heights. My take on AIG is America is gullible.
Well, AIG is rebranding itself as the financial joke of the century. You're just filling in the blanks. What does AIG stand for? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Would you lend money not just to your friends or to your family, but to a small business owner in a local community? Microfinance has been hot in Africa and many other continents. Is it going to come to the U.S.? We will tell you more shortly. But first, we have Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thanks, Farai. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama is in California today for a town hall meeting on the economy with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger is one of a few Republican governors supporting the president's stimulus package. The president will also be on The Tonight Show tonight with Jay Leno. New Mexico is the latest state to bar the death penalty, and the governor signed a bill last night to end it. It joins 14 other states in opposition to capital punishment. The governor has supported the death penalty in the past. He says he made the move because the justice system sometimes convicts the innocent. Fans, friends and family are mourning the late actress Natasha Richardson. The Tony Award winner died yesterday following a skiing accident. She leaves behind her husband, actor Liam Neeson, and two sons. And the president is making time for March Madness. He told ESPN that all the miles he'll be flying won't stop him from watching college basketball.
We've got the NATO summit, but we are going to be trying to catch as much of this as possible. Air Force One does have DirecTV.
The president has filled out a tournament bracket. His final four picks are Louisville, North Carolina, Memphis, and Pittsburgh. And he predicts North Carolina will win it all.
He puts Pittsburgh in there.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And he apparently knew his stuff. I was watching him on ESPN yesterday because I am such a jock, S. And he seemed to have done his homework. So that's a look at some of the stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you,
Femi. All right. Thanks so much. And we want to turn to the issue of microfinance. What would you do if you could get a small loan to help your business?
I want to put a deck on the front of the building to help my summer business because competition around me, there are vast numbers that are building decks because people want to be outside. They want the outside ambient noise. You know, they want the sun on their face. So I want to put like a 30 by 60 foot deck with a little bar out there with some umbrellas and, you know, give people another venue to, you know, chill out at.
Well, it sounds great. Sign me up for a frosty drink with a little umbrella in it and a big one on top. But how is Ed Murphy going to get the money? Well, you've probably heard about micro-lending overseas. You give a small amount, say $25, to a farmer in Kenya, and that farmer invests in his own business or her own business and pays back the loan. Everyone wins, including the folks who then re-gift to other people who need money. What if you were asked to put up collateral for your own community in the United States? Would you do it? You'll have an opportunity later this year when Kiva, an online microlender, launches a program in the U.S. There's no guarantee that Americans are going to be willing to loan to one another. Premal Shah is the president of Kiva Microloans. Premal, do you think that, you know, are the rules abroad really going to apply well here?
Well, I think entrepreneurship is everywhere, and there is microfinance today here in the U.S. And we think that on the website, you know, people will want to fund, say, a hot dog vendor or a shoe shiner or someone who wants to start a daycare business. And typically the repayment rates are in the 90% for these microfinance borrowers here in the U.S. So I think it'll be fairly similar, although the loan sizes might be higher. In the developing world, say in Uganda, maybe $25 or $75 goes a very long way. Here in the United States, typically we need to see more like a $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 starter loan.
Now, I'm going to actually play a little bit more from someone, you know, getting to the question of whether or not this is viable. This is New Jersey restaurant owner Jaime Chavez.
There's people out there with money that have a little bit more character and integrity, and they, you know, they believe in people keeping their word. And I think that's what pretty much Microloan did for us. You know, they looked at my business, and you know, they looked at my word, my business, my character, and that's, you know, I think that somebody with money will be willing to, you know, do that for somebody who needs help.
Now, when you think about someone like that who has an ethical look or, you know, based on his character and integrity, those are very ethics-based words. And microcredit has been viewed as something where people's view of ethics and repaying others and helping others comes into play. But, you know, do you think it really will work if people make an appeal that's an ethics-based appeal as well as a financial-based appeal?
Well, I think people like the idea of helping other people. People donate all sorts of causes. And so when you go to, for example, the Kiva website, you know, what you're doing is you're making a 0% interest loan over the site to a local microfinance institution who will then unlend that money at a very low interest rate to, say, a daycare owner or a hot dog stand vendor, someone who needs a little bit of working capital to start or expand their business. And that's a very American notion, the idea of giving someone a little bit of seed capital and an opportunity, you know, over charity oftentimes, to help them create income for themselves and their family. And so, you know, right now on the Kiva website, the repayment rate is 97.7% on about $60 million in loans that have been done from 450,000 people $25 at a time around the world. And so, you know, if someone from the U.S. is now seeking a loan and in these hard economic times, my sense is that they will be quite popular, just like if someone from Mexico or Uganda or Cambodia is seeking a loan on the Kiva website.
Well, let's get into the incentive structure here, though. I mean, on the one hand, you're talking about a charitable impulse, Premal Shah, that is one category of, you know, reasons someone might want to put capital up. Then you're talking about, you know, the possibility of a return on investment, which is a more traditional kind of capitalist notion of, you know, the interest rate pays me back. I'm making an investment here. It seems that this is more of a middle ground, the kind of social entrepreneurship zone, but not for the Bill Gateses of the world, on a much smaller scale for people with maybe only a few thousand to actually contribute. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think it is. In fact, it's less than a few thousand to contribute. Our minimum is $25. So if you have $25 and a credit card and an internet connection, you can go to the website, to kiva.org, and sift through profiles of entrepreneurs all over the world, and soon in the United States as well. And these are low-income, self-employed entrepreneurs who need a little bit of working capital. And this is something that, the repayment rates on the website, because these entrepreneurs tend to be unbanked and shut out from the formal kind of financial sector. In fact, here in the U.S., 30% of Americans have no banking relationship whatsoever. The people receiving loans oftentimes know that this is their one shot at kind of getting low-cost working capital and take it very seriously, and hence the repayment rates can be quite high.
Well, to that point, here's another one from Jamie Chavez.
They look at you and they listen to you and they, you know, they spend some time with you and they come and they look at your business and what you're doing and what, you know, where you are going. They just don't call you and bring you into an office and punch in some numbers and then at the end of the 10 million they told you to go home with nothing.
He was talking about the great experience he had getting a microloan in 2008 versus the somewhat more difficult time he had at a bank. And, you know, we have to wrap it up here, but when can we expect full-fledged Kiva USA?
Well, we think sometime this summer people will be able to make loans to entrepreneurs here in the U.S. via the Kiva website.
Well, that was my guest, Premal Shah, and Premal Shah, president of Kiva.
Well, it's a startup term, right?
Bledged. I know, bledged. Yeah, it's when you pledge to work until you bleed. And okay,
nice.
Kiva's
good
an online domestic microlending website. Calling us from San Francisco was Premal Shah. Thanks again. And John?
AIG is not part of the micro lending program at the Federal Treasury. No, does AIG's bailout money and the bonuses it produced make you angry?
I have a suggestion for a rebranding of AIG. Astoundingly incorrigible greed.
How about all in Geithner?
AIG has been renamed by the executives who have given back half of their bonus. It now stands for Ain't I Generous.
Some of you think that AIG actually doesn't need any rebranding.
My name is Kevin Verner. I'm calling from Charleston, South Carolina. I'm actually one of the few that don't have a problem with the AIG bonuses, as reprehensible as they are. They are contracts. And when I see the Attorney General of New York, Cuomo, quoted as saying that he understands legally binding contracts, the times have changed, that scares the daylights out of me.
Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Remember, Sweden advised America how to get out of its financial crisis based on its experience of the 1990s. If you want to hear what Bo Lundgren had to say, podcast on iTunes and available at our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.